Ridiculous History is a production of iHeartRadio. Welcome back to the show, folks. This is Ridiculous History. My name is Ben.
My name is Nolan. It's not Ridiculous Historians.
It's not. That's our Facebook group. But hey, look at us. We're getting the plug in early.
Yeah, join the Facebook group if you like the show. We always save it for the end. Maybe we'll see a giant spike in activity, a flurry of activity on our Facebook group.
A cavalcade of content. Speaking of cavalcades of awesomeness, we want to give a shout out to our super producer, Casey Pegram.
There he is. Look at him. Look at our boy, Casey.
There he is.
The glint in his eye, as always.
We should mention that today's episode is pretty fascinating to us. We started talking with some friends of ours off air about the most petty or strangest flexes in human history.
Ben, you're going to have to hip me to this lingo here. What is a flex?
Ah, well, who better to explain that than our friends that we actually brought on the air for the episode today, the host of one of our favorite podcasts, The Daily Zeitgeist.
Yeah, we have Miles and Jack from The Daily Zeitgeist joining us as we speak. Gentlemen.
What's up, guys?
Hello.
It's Jack. How are you?
So these guys,
us.
Miles and Jack are the anchors of our Los Angeles operation. They do a lot of comedy. They have this amazing political comedy show that they do every day of the week. And they're kind of the cooler versions of us. So can you guys explain what a flex is?
Yes. Flex, if we go strictly by the Urban Dictionary definition, would be a verb in which someone would show off or gloat in a boastful display.
Wow. Yes. That was very official, Miles.
Thank you so much.
Yes.
Yeah, so that's what a flex is.
How is a flex different than a stunt?
I mean, it's kind of the same thing. A stunt, you're still kind of showing out, as
Got
you
it.
Will.
Yeah.
But sometimes a flex, you know, it's really about like, you know, I think coming from flexing your muscles, like kind of showing how strong you are, or showing off that way.
I feel like a flex can come from within, maybe, where a stunt can be, a stunt would be more like you showing off things.
Yes.
I don't know.
Maybe no, you nailed it. You nailed it.
Thank you so much.
But yeah, I mean, essentially, it's all the same thing. It's just sort of, you know, and then the gave way to the weird flex phenomenon,
right,
which was just sort of like, you know, just recontextualizing people's quotes or things to be boastful moments.
Right.
But yeah, it's really just about showing off, really, or yeah, unnecessarily showing your power or wealth or something like that.
I love weird flex because it has taken over for people used to say anytime they wanted to make fun of someone for bragging about something weird, they'd be like humble brag. And they just didn't know what humble brag meant.
Right.
I think they misunderstood. So weird flex is actually an accurate way to make fun of somebody for bragging about something weird. And we're happy you're here, weird flex.
Like, for example, setting the record for eating the largest amount of cheese in 24 hours. That's a weird flex.
That is a weird flex.
Yeah.
And then bragging about it.
And then bragging about it.
Well, and since this is Ridiculous History, today we're talking about weird historical flexes. Ben, you brought this one to the table, so I think maybe you should start.
Sure, yeah. We're going to explore not all of, but some of the weirdest flexes and maybe the most petty power moves throughout this ridiculous thing that we call human history. So I'm going to lay one out just to set the tone here. We've all heard of garden gnomes, right?
Which is already a weird flex in and of itself.
Yeah, it's a strange choice.
Very much so.
Landscaping.
The fact
was.
That I have the second largest collection of garden gnomes on the east side of Los Angeles, I'm not going to brag about that. That because that would be a weird flex. But
I'll
just leave it out there.
But I know East LA is pretty competitive and cutthroat in that regard, right?
Yeah,
man. It's taken a lot of hard work, and I just give thanks to my parents for, you know, raising me the way they did. And yeah, but go on with
it. Jessica Sable has not recovered since you retook the throne.
Oh, man.
The garden gnome
second
king.
Most.
Yes,
garden
second
gnome.
Most.
Yeah. Garden gnome prince, the garden gnome king. Prince, I'm never going to beat him.
Vice garden gnome president.
Yes.
So this should be close to you personally, because it turns out that there is an historical precedent in the creation of this sort of garden gnome, I guess we can call it an industry now, at least in Los Angeles.
Culture? Gnome culture. That's what I'm going to call
the gnomon culture.
Gnome life.
Boom.
So there was this moment, primarily during the 18th century, when wealthy landowners in Britain said, you know, how can I show my fellow landed aristocrats that I am somehow better than them, you know, without actually doing something to improve myself? And they decided that they would resurrect an old practice of paying someone to be a professional hermit, an ornamental hermit, in their garden. And these guys had a really weird gig. First off, they were expected to, in some cases, not bathe, not talk to anyone for 7 years. They had to dress like, quote, a druid. But the problem was these wealthy landowners had no clue what a druid actually looked like. So they looked more like the modern version of train kids, you know, minus the stick and poke face tattoos. And the weird thing about it was it caught on. There's a great book called The Hermit in the Garden, From Imperial Rome to Ornamental Gnome, like the rhyme there, that traces the evolution of this from back in the 15th century when Francis of Paola was one of the first paid hermits in a cave on his own dad's estate. So how's that for nepotism?
Let me unpack this just briefly. I just want to make sure that I'm getting the right picture
here.
Go
for it.
So they're paying like smelly hobo types to hang around in their yard.
Yes. Yep. And in some case, and they have their own special kind of like hermit habitats. You know how if you have
like
fish,
a terrarium kind of, or
sort of like, yeah, if you have fish, there's the fake ubiquitous sandcastle that the fish quote unquote lives in.
Yeah. The little diver,
right,
in a helmet or whatever.
Yeah. Uh-huh. They had a small
treasure chest.
Yes.
Of course.
Of course,
bubbles that come out.
Of course,
yes.
With a chest, because otherwise, what the hell are you doing with this fish?
Mm-hmm.
So I'm glad you guys have my back on this. So they have these different tiers of hermitage. Some of them are expected to come out when visitors walk by and then do things that, you know, we would probably find offensive in the modern day, like come up and recite spoken word without an invitation or a solicitation.
There's literally a dude that hangs outside my neighborhood bar that does that every time I walk past him. And he thinks that I don't remember that I've already heard the one poem that he has.
Oh, you're talking about Ticket.
That's the guy.
Yeah.
And it's like, he's like, hey, I got a new one. I'm like, bro, it's not a new one.
It's
I've heard it. And
one.
I literally have it memorized at this point, and I'm not giving you a dollar.
At this point, I can do his ad libs.
To flex on him, you should come up to him and say, I have a poem for you, and tell him his own poem to his face.
Yes.
Oh, wow. He might even say, I love that. I've never heard that before.
That's also true.
So the thing that they were attempting to do with this was to recreate a sort of idealized time in history that never actually existed. The hermits eventually became the inspiration for the gnome sculptures that were so prominent and prevalent today in Los Angeles. But the concept of these being a normal thing in ancient Roman villas and so on isn't that accurate. Like so many 18th century British beliefs, it was based on complete malarkey. It never actually happened in a widespread fashion in ancient civilizations, but that didn't stop people. The facts will never stop you from having a good time with a weird flex. The last thing, the most famous of the ornamental hermits, is a guy named John Big with two G's. It's a nice surname. The Dinton Hermit. He was not himself a garden hermit, but in a lot of the publications of the time, he was called like the OG hermit. And they explore like how you're supposed to interact with these people. You walk up to them, even if you're the owner of this garden, you walk up to the hermit's hideout or his hidey hole or his treasure chest and, you know, his equivalent of his treasure chest and his castle. And then you ring a bell or you knock or you say a phrase. And then the hermit comes out and depending upon what the owners want from this guy, they either, of course, start speaking in weird riddles or spoken word, or they pretend not to see you and maybe silently pray to themselves or work on some, like, I kid you not, arrangement of shells in a way that is supposed to look purposeful and super deep. As you could tell, this is a short-lived trend. It died out in the early 19th century or so when weirder flexes rose. The thing was, we can only imagine that this stuff was really a status symbol when not many people were doing it. So when the ornamental hermit became closer to being commonplace, its social value decreased because people were like, oh, you got a hermit?
So there was a hermit bubble, basically, bursts.
Yeah, the tulip bubble.
Absolutely.
People start getting cheap knockoff garden hermits, and
right.
then the whole thing just went down the tubes.
I mean, the hermit bubble really hurt a lot of people. I remember someone I dated, their family, they were upside down
when
the hermit bubble burst, yeah.
I feel like this is really a testament to how, like, this is one of those pastimes from history that really is a testament to how boring life used to be. Like, that people would just go and see a guy who didn't want you to interact with him and, like, play, like, a weird, like, troll password game with them. And it was, yeah, it's just... And it's also, you know, the economy was not overly diverse back in the day. So, you know, you needed to create work for your weird son who never wanted to leave the house. And so it sounds like that kind of got it started was just having a kid at home who you couldn't get off the couch. And so you're like, what if we dressed him in weird clothes and made him live under a rock in the backyard?
And then luckily that gave rise to art school.
And that gave
people place to also arrange shells ornamentally.
I feel like there's another analog here, you guys, in the whole Hollywood universe where you have these glitzy parties where people are kind of paid to just wander around dressed in costumes, whatever the theme is. I could see this being brought back for some sort of weird flex Hollywood party where you just have these oddly dressed kind of like court jester types just wandering around and reciting riddles to people. How do you guys feel about this?
I mean, I think that makes sense. You know, it's always a flex even just to hire someone to do something that doesn't even seem like a job.
Right.
And you can be like, yeah, I'm paying somebody to do that. That's because that's where my wealth is at.
Exactly.
And it's the same thing. It reminds me of even like at bar mitzvahs. Yeah. There's like pump up dancers that you hire for that.
Yeah.
It's like, they're just lightening up the mood. Oh, I don't know them, but I hired them because I can.
My social life currently is mostly involves going to 2 to 3 year old birthday parties, not involving my kids at all, just because that's what I'm into these days. But there's always like a Disney princess or some actor who came to Hollywood to chase their dreams, who is playing, usually it's Elsa, although I actually saw the bubble burst on Elsa in the past couple weeks. People just stopped really caring about Elsa. And she was literally chasing the kids around because nobody would talk to her.
Oh, no.
Really? Oh, because they're like, oh, Elsa's so 3 years ago.
Yeah. Yeah. She was like, I have to do something. This is too awkward.
Kids are so cruel.
Yeah, kids are very cruel. It's not that different. I guess it's just that it's almost like turning a little part of your garden into a historical reenactment town.
Yeah.
Which we also have.
A woefully inaccurate one.
Right, right.
Yeah. A bit of a step up from traditional slavery. Right. It's like, hi, I'll clothe you, and you get to kind of just be you or do something weird, okay? I'll be back. Here's some food and a couple shekels.
Yeah, and were they just kind of paid or paid in food and the shelter? Or
that was my question.
Board.
That's right, yeah.
They had room and board. They received a stipend. The usual contract was for 7 years. The stipend, though, you know, whenever somebody says stipend instead of a salary, you know it's not a huge chunk of scratch. Right. But the last thing that was fascinating about this to me, and a very, very damning comment on society at the time, is that Britain at the time was full of incredibly destitute, impoverished, or homeless people. So, of course, someone would end up taking this job. And it's not surprising if someone's like telling their kids, all right, goodbye, you know, little Darren or whatever. Dad has to go off and pretend to be a homeless mystic for 7 years
yep.
so that we can get your leg fixed.
Do you think his children are allowed to visit little tiny
no.
Tim? No?
No.
No.
No, hermits no, I mean, don't I have families.
Like no contact. There's a no contact
yeah.
rule.
Yeah.
That is a very, I mean, very weird flex. Just societally, I would say that's a weird flex.
But I think it's kind of, it could come back around, right? Where even in this country, you have, we have growing populations of just the destitute or people who are not faring well in the economy. And eventually people at the very top could be like, oh yeah, I hired these five people to do Paw Patrol for my kids for 3 years.
Right.
Right.
Exactly. But that is my that is my first entry into our weird flex show, and it sounds like we can all agree. Oh, maybe that's what we can do at the end. We can vote on whether or not that's a weird flex. I think it is, obviously.
I think it is too. And another thing that I think is, I think this might have enough weird flex ammunition to make two weird flex episodes.
This alone.
Yes,
yeah,
this
yeah.
alone. I'm just putting that out there right now. Mm-hmm. Fingers crossed. I could be proven wrong, but I would like to throw it to our guests. You talk amongst yourselves. Who would like to go next?
I could go. By the way, if you guys are George Saunders fans, he's a fiction writer, and he has a short story, I think, in 10th of December that
yes!
is like sort of a weird futuristic version of this, that where it's like they... There are people who are paid to reenact lynchings in people's gardens in the near future in the American South, and it's like this weird class consciousness thing that that I don't know goes off the rails, but it's very, very creepy and interesting story that makes me think he knew about this phenomenon.
Totally.
When he was writing it, so I want to talk to you guys about a time when the human species was still a little bit insecure about our place on top of the food chain. And this is back when Charles Darwin was kicking around and, you know, he was actually discovering that we weren't all that different from our animal brethren and that, you know, we were all part of the same evolutionary stew as a lot of animals. A thing that a lot of people don't know about Darwin, though, is that he basically ate every animal that he ever documented. Like that was his, he kind of viewed it as part of the scientific process, but it seems to go deeper than that because even when he was a kid at Cambridge, you know, Harvard, if you've seen The Social Network, you know that they have, instead of like sorority and fraternity houses, they have like dining clubs. And at Cambridge, they had something similar. But Darwin started something called the Glutton Club, which was a group of students devoted to devouring, quote, birds and beasts, which were before unknown to human palate. They toasted hawk. They ate a heron-like wading bird called a bittern, and they were dissolved after trying to eat a brown owl, which you're not supposed to eat those. Darwin said the taste was indescribable. So that might seem strange for a guy who then went on to devote his life to, you know, documenting animals in their natural habitat.
Does it seem strange? He might just have a thing.
Yeah, so I kind of always associated him with, you know, science and biology and, you know, putting humans in their place on the in natural history. But he was more about putting us in our place, but then also reminding every animal he encountered that we could still eat them if we wanted to. Because
right.
during the course of his journeys on the Beagle, he ate puma, he ate iguanas, armadillos. He not only ate giant tortoises, he ate like so many of the giant tortoises he documented that there weren't any left when he got back to England. He had eaten like 20-something of them.
Jesus.
And he also tried drinking their bladder contents. You said the fluid was quite limpid and slightly bitter taste.
You got to drink the bladder contents for science.
I have that on a plaque somewhere.
Yeah, it's on my license plate. This is incredible because I think of him, and this is obviously misguided, but I've always thought of Darwin as like a conservationist, but that's never even what he was pitched as, honestly. I mean, he was a documenter and he, you know, wrote down detailed notes about all these things, but he wasn't exactly out there to like save the wildlife. And this just pushes that point home. Go on, man. Yeah. This is fascinating and bizarre.
I mean, to me, it's all cover, right? I think we have it all wrong thinking, oh, he was some kind of scientist.
Right.
His main goal was to eat as many animals as possible. I think of him as actually the first Guy Fieri. Really had nothing to do with science. The science bit was just a cover to be like, you see Chuck again? Yeah, he's drinking turtle pee. I know. He's talking about his evolution thing. Poor guy.
Because even if we're being generous, we can say, okay, one turtle, you know, you might be in a situation when you're like, when am I going to be here again? But 20? 20?
Right.
Yeah.
Look, we've all been to, the Galapagos Island and, you know, tried to eat one of the turtles.
Well, but first you gotta ride
stop
one.
After the one.
You gotta ride the turtle
ride
first.
It around.
And then you knock it in the head and then you eat it. That's just how you do. That's the order of operations on the Galapagos.
They frown on that in my experience, but maybe you had a cooler guide.
The first thing I do when I see a turtle is try and dump toxic ooze on it.
Right.
That it will then turn into some kind of hero ninja mutant.
Yeah. And it's a
you
numbers
guys don't
game.
Know this. Miles is wearing a cheese shredder on his face. Like
what?
Shredder. Yeah.
Do you guys have a guy for toxic ooze, though, is my question. Because
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
LA, man? Oh, I can get you toxic ooze.
We'll talk.
It's a buyer's market.
We'll talk off air.
Well, it's specialized, too. There's certain kinds for mammals, and there's other ones for reptiles and ones for insects.
Yeah, as there should be. That makes sense. Did this ever become a matter of controversy in Darwin's life? Like, did anybody ever say, hey, man, you can just eat one tortoise?
I mean, I think, So I think it was actually more common than you would expect, because there's also a great scientist named William Buckland. He was the first person to publish a scientific study of a dinosaur. And he made it his life's mission to eat one of every animal that existed. And he even at one point ate a human heart. So they were around at the same time. So apparently this was just a way to kind of flex your scientific legitimacy to the world. Just be like, yo, this is how I get down. I'm showing my superiority over the natural world by putting it in my stomach.
You know, it also occurs to me that this is kind of a weird reverse Noah's Ark kind of scenario, where instead of like saving one of every animal, you're going to eat one of every animal just to show that you've got one over on these dumb creatures and that you are, you know, the top of the food chain. And they better know that.
I mean, as a scientist, when you spend that much time around the animals, you really come to understand that they think they're better than you.
Yeah.
And that they need to be put in their place.
So, yeah.
But just two quick facts that I found particularly interesting. He ate a 20-pound rodent and said it was the very best meat he had ever tasted. So rodent meat is apparently underrated. Huh. And at one point, his hunger came into contrast with his scientific drive, because he had spent months trying to find this ostrich-like bird called a lesser rhea, and he was eating what he thought to be a greater rhea, and about halfway through his portion of greater rhea, he realized, oh no, that bone being there means this is actually a lesser rhea, the thing I've been looking for forever. So he had to basically send this animal he was hoping to scientifically document back to England as just a bunch of like chicken bones and skin and feathers, because he had eaten most of it.
So he sent them leftovers?
Yes. Yeah, exactly. He did send it in a styrofoam clamshell container.
I have to do it. Did he then get diarrhea?
Hmm? Oh.
Huh?
You no. can only imagine.
I had to. I had to. There's the lesser.
You had to.
I had
and
to.
Yeah. You are absolved.
I know.
That was necessary.
Thank you.
Somebody had to say it.
They had to
Otherwise,
say it. It had to be said.
The Thanks. Guest was going to yeah. feel unfulfilled.
Hold on. Let's wait for the judges. And yes, we will accept it.
We will right, accept cool. that.
Thanks Thank for, you. Thanks for taking one for the team, Noel.
Yeah, of course. Glad to do it.
So we really appreciate that.
So far, we have two, I would say, legitimate flexes, legitimately weird at least.
Yeah.
And both are somewhat cruel when you think about it. You know, I think the gambit was correct in the beginning. I think this is a two-part episode.
And, you know, I really hate it when podcasters say, well, we're running out of time, so we're going to make this a two-parter. Shenanigans.
No,
our episodes can be as long as we want. We just are trying to get two episodes out of this because we're lazy.
No, well, I mean, maybe that's where you're coming from, Noel. I'm not going to lie. I was going to walk outside and see if there was some kind of rodent that I could eat for science, because apparently that's
right.
okay now. You know?
Well, Ben, we're
delicious.
Very different people, Ben. We're very
we
different people.
Very different people.
Lazy and hungry.
Lazy and hungry. That's it. That's the that's our combo. Before we go on this episode, though, a very, very important question that I know everybody listening is waiting to hear. Which of the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles is your favorite, or which one do you identify with the most? I couldn't let it be unsaid.
I was more of a casual Turtles fan, so I was more Michelangelo, just the everybody's first choice when they're young and first getting to know it.
Yeah,
because
Michelangelo,
be cool.
he's like a rebel.
Yeah, he's a rebel who likes pizza just like me.
I mean, they all love pizza, but he really loves
he
pizza.
He loves pizza, loves.
Yeah, for me, I liked Michelangelo for the swag, the confidence,
right. yes.
the rebellious attitude.
The weird flexes.
But in the end, I kind of settled. I was more of a Donatello guy.
Okay.
Because I like blue.
Donatello yeah, was really the smart one, right? Didn't Donatello, wasn't he the science-y guy?
Yeah, Donatello has inventions. And the bow staff.
The bow staff, which is admittedly the most boring of the Ninja Turtles' weapons, in my opinion.
Really?
I think Michelangelo, the nunchucks, are obviously the most fun. He's got two of them. He can swing them around, do all kinds of crazy tricks.
But he's got no reach, Noel. He's got no reach.
What do you mean he's got no reach?
He's got no reach with the nunchucks. You got to be really active to weld the... Okay, I'm just... My bias is showing I'm also Team Donatello.
You're on Team Donatello.
Hell
okay.
yeah, I am.
Yeah. I always liked Raphael because he was tortured.
I misspoke, actually. I misspoke. I meant to say Leonardo.
Leonardo?
Because Leonardo's the one who wears blue.
Oh, that's right,
he
isn't it?
He did wear blue.
Yes.
But Donatello was still the sciencey guy. Leonardo was sort of the de facto leader,
Yeah,
I
he's
believe.
Like the Cyclops of the Turtles X-Men.
That's right. I was always Michelangelo. I'm with that. And I was not a casual Turtles fan. I've seen both the original film and the Secret of the Ooze.
And the reboot.
I know the ninja rap by heart, and I had the cassette called Coming Out of Our Shells that was distributed with Domino's Pizzas back in the day.
But did you have the toy?
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
Do you remember that Sam Rockwell is in the first Teenage Mutant
yes!
Ninja Turtles?
Yes! That's right.
Yes!
Well, yeah. Isn't he in the Foot? Isn't he in the Foot Clan?
Yeah, he's like the main sort of like forward-facing foot guy recruiting
the big
teens.
Foot.
Like, hey,
he's
you like cigarettes?
He's like Fagin from Oliver. He's like recruiting little street urchin kids. Totally. Yeah. I forgot that
he's
was
I still
foot.
Stand by that as his greatest work as an actor.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah. He agrees. I think he has gone on record with that.
Yeah, it's that and then Moon. Yeah. Moon would be number two for me.
But
I really enjoyed it.
Distant number two.
Agreed.
But so we are going to pause for today's episode. We'll be back with the second part of Weirdest Historical Flexes. In the meantime, we'll forego our usual, this is where you can find us on the internet, because we did that at the front.
We did it up front. We still have to thank everybody, though, yeah?
Yes. We want to thank, of course, our super producer, Casey Pegram, Alex Williams, who composed our track.
Yes, our fabulous research associate, Gabe Lugier, our buddy, Christopher Hasiotis, who is due for an appearance. I actually had lunch with Christopher the other day, and he really misses us, and he's so happy to see the show doing well.
Why didn't you invite me?
It was in a different city.
Ice cold.
I'm really sorry, Ben. Next time.
You're an ice cold dude.
I am not, Ben. I'm not. I'm a sweetheart. But we'd also like to thank our incredible guests who are going to stick around, if you would, for part two of this kind of anthology episode on Ridiculous History.
Yeah, thanks so much for coming, guys. Where can people, while they're waiting for this next episode, where can they hear more from you, Miles and Jack?
Oh, you can find us every day on this network on our show, The Daily Zeitgeist, every morning or whenever you want to listen to it.
Yeah.
And if you're interested in social media, I mean, you can follow me at Miles of Gray, wherever you get your social media.
Yeah. And Jack_O'Brien on Twitter. And yes, so much of us. You can find so much of us over at The Daily Zeitgeist. wherever fine podcasts are given away for free.
And I guess we can drop our little social media handles too. I on Instagram am at Embryonic Insider.
You can see me get kicked into and out of various countries around the world at Ben Bolin on Instagram. So that's all for now. Everybody run off. I'm gonna hunt some rodents. We're gonna talk about the turtles and maybe rewatch Secret of the Ooze, and we'll be back very soon.
We'll see you next time, folks. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.